thank you very much. I wasn't planning to tell any jokes at all. How am I going to follow that speech? But it did remind me of an absolutely true story, unlike some of the ones that we just heard. This is a certified true story. It seems that the then unknown governor of Illinois, Adlai Stevenson, was going to give a speech at a banquet in New York. And he had the good fortune, or bad, depending on your point of view, of being introduced by Fred Allen, who was in fabulous form and gave a brilliant, polished, devastatingly funny introduction to the governor, who at that point was completely unknown. And everybody wondered how he was going to follow that, so he got up and said, I was sitting next to Fred Allen on the dais, and we were chatting before his speech. We decided it might be funny if we swapped speeches. Unfortunately, I was sitting across from you, so I'm going to give the one I wrote. We're here to talk about American renewal. It's interesting to consider what we would have been talking about had we been doing the same thing exactly a year ago. As it happens, I was giving a speech in Washington exactly a year ago, but it wasn't about renewal. It was about the elections of 2000 and what their results told us about America, the two Americas, what we've become accustomed to calling red and blue America. Now, my topic for today is the restoration of beauty and truth, and I normally write about the arts, but even a critic of the arts can't ignore the world around him, try though he might. And in any case, there's nothing normal about the world these days. I just turned in the final copy-edited manuscript of my biography of Mencken 3 days ago. And as I gave it one last read, I looked at the date at the end of the preface, the day I finally finished a book I had spent 10 years writing, September 4th, 2001. What a difference a week makes. Having already been convulsed by the most divisive election of modern times, both Americas now found themselves convulsed yet again, this time by an act of barbarity so horrendous that all at once, in the twinkling of an eye, we seemed to be one nation again. It's true that the two nations seemed to approve, quite overwhelmingly, of the leadership of the man who divided them so deeply in November of 2000. But most of us here today are old enough to remember how the Cold War created a kind of cultural consensus that, while not factitious, nevertheless proved to be somewhat deceptive. Long before the evil empire breathed its last, we knew that American culture was deeply divided. And once the Soviet threat had ceased to exist, that fault line became more apparent than ever before. Similarly, I have no doubt that once the empire of terror is finally vanquished, if not before, we will be arguing once again, not about the need to defend ourselves against madmen with bombs and box cutters, but about exactly what it is we claim to be defending. I rejoice in George W. Bush's approval rating, but I also remember the exit polls that told us that 63% of American voters who go to church more than once a week voted for him, while 61% of voters who never go to church voted for his opponent. Nevertheless, I come bearing good tidings. Qualified, but on the whole, pretty good. I'm not here to tell you that the fault line that runs through American culture was healed on September 11th. I know better than that, and you should too. But even before September 11th, there was something in the air, something encouraging. Now, my understanding is that conservatives aren't supposed to find anything encouraging. But as a critic, I'm in the business of sniffing the air and reporting on what I smell. And for some time now, I've been catching an interesting scent. Sitting in a McDonald's on New York's Upper West Side 3 months ago, I heard something surprising. Diana Krall's recording of The Look of Love. The surprise was that it was playing on the radio. It was, after all, an old-fashioned romantic ballad sung by a jazz musician. Such records had vanished from the airwaves decades ago. What was this one doing playing on the radio in a fast food joint? The answer is simple. It was a hit. At the time, The Look of Love was the eighth biggest selling CD on Amazon.com, and not just among jazz albums, but all albums. And this success could not be written off as a mere exercise in salesmanship. Yes, Diana had been quite skillfully marketed, but the fact remains that huge numbers of ordinary listeners, many of them raised on rock, were, and are, happily paying to hear a jazz singer perform ballads from the Great American Songbook. Now, is Diana's mass popularity a fluke, or is it a sign of a sea change in American culture? I'm not fond of trend sniffing, but it seemed to me at the time, and still does, that the success of The Look of Love might possibly have had something to do with the events of September 11th. Turn back your mental clock to September 10th. If you had spent that day sitting in a classroom in any major American college or university, listening to a lecture on literature or music or art, the chances are good that you would have heard a lot, a whole lot, about something called postmodernism. Taken literally, postmodernism means nothing more than that which came after modernism. And by the 60s, the modern movement in art, for all its immense significance, was nearing the end of its run. Not that all modernists had ceased to do major work, but the movement as a whole, as movements will do, had degenerated into an increasingly rigid ideology whose spokesmen habitually drew false conclusions from false premises. Those were the days when abstract painting, atonal music, and plotless dance were being presented as historically inevitable, a quasi-Marxist argument whose makers, not infrequently, sought to quash dissent, also a la Marx. It was time for change, but the one that came would prove reminiscent of H.L. Mencken's sardonic remark that democracy is the theory that the common people know what they want and deserve to get it, good and hard. For all the reams of impenetrable prose that have been penned on the subject of postmodernism, its underlying premise is perfectly straightforward. Postmodernists disbelieve in truth and beauty, claiming instead that nothing is good, true, or beautiful in and of itself. Rather, goodness, truth, beauty, and quality are constructs imposed by the powerful on the powerless for political purposes. Hence, there can be no great art and no great artists. Shakespeare, Beethoven, Cezanne, mere capitalist tools used to anesthetize the masses and prop up the decadent ruling classes of the West. Under the aspect of postmodernism, randomness is just as good as order. Noise as good as music, and all artistic statements are created equal, though those made by the ostensibly powerless are more equal than others. Accordingly, postmodern audiences were expected to make do with the resoundingly empty gestures of minimalist music and conceptual art in which theory replaced content. I've often had occasion to quote Hugh Kenner's remark that conceptual art is that which, once described, need not be experienced. In the entire history of art, no important theoretical movement has produced more theory and less art than postmodernism. Ultimately, it amounted to little more than a set of critical attitudes, foremost among them the marginalization of the idea of beauty and its replacement with the sniggering, fearful irony light that was the hallmark of American culture in the 90s. It was, at bottom, a loss of nerve. We lost the courage of our aesthetic and cultural convictions. Clement Greenberg, the great art critic, once wrote, "In the long run, there are only two kinds of art, the good and the bad. This difference cuts across all other differences in art. At the same time, it makes all art one. The experience of art is the same in kind or order, despite all differences in works of art themselves." Greenberg was, of course, exactly right. But by choosing instead to embrace aesthetic relativism, postmodernism made possible the rise of a new generation of cultural totalitarians, so secure in their belief that the personal is political, that they dismissed with ignorant contempt any art they could not reduce to a laundry list of compulsory platitudes. Thus did the Stalinist Philistinism of the 30s, the stridently drab decade of The Cradle Will Rock and The Grapes of Wrath, return with a vengeance in the 80s and 90s, though in a sense it had never really gone away, Philistinism being an inevitable byproduct of zealotry in all its forms. In the days immediately following September 11th, W.H. Auden's September 1, 1939, crackled across the internet like a samizdat newsletter. It was bracing in those desperate days to open a piece of email and find Auden's lines about the low, dishonest decade that was the 30s. Though I remember thinking at the time that another of his poems might have been even more to the point. "Either we serve the unconditional, or some Hitlerian monster will supply an iron convention to do evil by." So he has. But on September 11th, the unconditional started looking good again. For on that never-to-be-forgotten morning, Americans awakened to the crudest possible reminder that some things aren't a matter of opinion. You cannot explain away 3,000 freshly slaughtered corpses. And outside of the pseudo-intellectual lunatic fringe, few tried. And those who dared to defend the indefensible were promptly relegated to the margins of respectable society, exposed for the trousered apes they were and are. All at once, my fashion-obsessed Manhattan neighborhood was awash in fear and bedecked with flags, and the word evil re-entered the vocabulary of a generation of educated innocents who thought there was no such thing. Something similar happened when, a few days later, musicians in New York and elsewhere began giving memorial concerts to which the public flocked. And what did we come to hear? Yo-Yo Ma played Bach at Carnegie Hall. Placido Domingo sang Verdi at the Metropolitan Opera House. Kurt Mazur and the New York Philharmonic broadcast Brahms's German Requiem to the entire country over PBS. And did anybody complain because the Met performed Verdi instead of Schoenberg or Philip Glass? To ask the question is to know the answer. In Debussy's opera, Pelléas and Mélisande, old King Arkel sings, "One greatly needs beauty when death is so close." Never before had I understood the meaning of those words. What we wanted in our time of need was beauty, and we never doubted for a moment that such a thing existed. Nor did we seek it in order to be healed. Art isn't therapy. Just as beauty is more like bread than medicine, we need it not merely to feel better, but to live. On the Sunday after the World Trade Center crumbled into dust, I flew over the southern tip of Manhattan, transfixed by the insane spectacle far below me, gaping in dumb wonder at the black hole in my home. Did postmodernism abruptly come to an end that week? The way Virginia Woolf claimed that on or about December 1910, human character changed? No. The change was already in the air. I'd already heard it in the concert halls, in the music of new tonalist composers like Paul Moravec and Lowell Lieberman, who had shrugged off the dead hand of the avant-garde and freely acknowledged the permanent validity of the natural law of tonality. I'd heard it in the nightclubs, where jazz musicians like Diana Krall and Bill Charlap find in the Great American Songbook a permanent source of inspiration and renewal. I'd seen it in the choreography of Mark Morris, whom I once took to be a postmodernist, but whom I now realize to be something completely different, a maker of dances set to the music of Bach, Brahms, and Beethoven, whose steps arise from his intense awareness of the hidden presence of order amid the seeming chaos of our wounded world. And I'd even seen it in movie theaters, where a growing number of independent-minded American directors are making films, like Whit Stillman's The Last Days of Disco or Kenneth Lonergan's You Can Count on Me, that engage directly and beautifully with the problem of postmodern relativism. Now, I don't want to sound overly optimistic. The anti-beauty brigade may be in temporary retreat, but it's nothing more than that. Such folks have two things going for them, tenure and patience. And even though they don't believe in anything, they disbelieve in it passionately. But their nihilism is no longer fashionable. Indeed, I believe that at some point in the 90s, we quietly entered a period for which no one has yet come up with a better word than postmodernism. It's a terrible word, and a better one will come along in time, but it has the advantages of reminding us that we are witnessing the emergence of a new generation of artists who, unlike the postmodernists who came before them, believe in beauty, who are willing to use that word without encasing it in the protective quotation marks of irony light. I was talking about this the other day with Paul Moravec, who is a neighbor of mine on the Upper West Side. Paul writes beautiful music, and I think great music. And I asked him what set him and his fellow new tonalists apart from their postmodern predecessors. Now, Paul has a philosophical turn of mind, and he thought a moment before answering. Then he told me, "The difference is that I try to compose beautiful things. I say what I mean, and mean what I say. The irony in my work is not glibly, facetiously postmodern, but rather the essence of making audible the experience of fundamental paradox and ambiguity." That is a very beautiful and thoughtful remark. But Osama bin Laden and his Taliban cronies, the ones who banned music from Afghanistan, would scarcely have approved of such talk. For them, As for every other zealot who murders in the name of a false god, earthly beauty is a mere illusion, a distraction from the one true cause. But if September 11th taught us anything, it was that beauty is real as evil, and worth fighting for. And that is what we are doing, unashamedly, and at last.